Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Richard II, Act II. Think what you will, we seize into our hands his plate, his goods, his money, and his lands. Gaunt upbraids Richard bitterly for his corrupt schemes. When Gaunt dies, Richard confiscates his estate, denying Bolingbroke his rights. Northumberland tells Willoughby and Ross that Bolingbroke is headed for England, and they vow to support him. In Act II, Scene 1, the mortally ill John of Gaunt, expressing the vain hope that, quote-unquote, the tongues of dying men enforce a tension like deep harmony, spends some of his last breath conversing with York. Act II, Scene 1, Lines 5 through 6. He soon turns prophetic and patriotic as he first castigates Richard in absentia, and then offers his famous description of England, beginning with, quote-unquote, this royal throne of kings, this sceptered isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 40 through 41. Gaunt seems most upset that Richard, his nephew, has engaged in various schemes to extort money from wealthy citizens as well as to rent out crown lands for a quick profit. The effect of this, says Gaunt, is that, quote-unquote, that England that was wont to conquer others hath made a shameful conquest of itself. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 65 through 66. Gaunt is referring to the falling off of English prowess against the French since the time of Edward III. This is the era, after all, of the long struggle between England and France that we call the Hundred Years' War. King Richard II enters directly after Gaunt has made this remark, and soon becomes impatient and sardonic. Gaunt infuriates Richard by speaking in the name of King Edward III, who he says would be ashamed of the way Richard is running the kingdom. The old man offers this devastating barb, quote-unquote, landlord of England art thou, and not king. Thy state of law is bond slave to the law. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 113 through 114. Richard, Gaunt is telling him, fails to measure up to the standard of Edward III. Among Gaunt's final words to Richard are, quote-unquote, live in thy shame, but die not shame with thee. These words hereafter thy tormentors be. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 135 through 136. That is unmistakably a curse issued from a dying uncle to a profligate, dissolute nephew king. Soon thereafter, word comes that Gaunt has died, and Richard's relief is palpable. Quote unquote, so much for that. Now for our Irish wars. Act 2, Scene 1, Line 155. To York's consternation, King Richard at once gives orders to confiscate everything of any value on or pertaining to Gaunt's estate, which should go to his son Henry Bolingbroke, even though he's exiled. York says, quote-unquote, take Hereford's rights away and take from time his charters and his customary rights. Let not tomorrow then ensue today. Be not thyself, for how art thou a king but by fair sequence and succession? Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 195 through 199. Fundamentally, York is pointing out, King Richard does not respect the feudal net of loyalties and obligations that legitimize and secure his rule. He is a feckless opportunist and does not take care to protect his own position or England's reputation as a law-abiding nation. The Duke of York, Edmund of Langley, is trying to explain to the heedless king that when he shreds the concept of primogeniture, he undercuts the legitimacy of his own rule. But Richard overrules such mature advice with a glib, rhyming couplet. He tells York, quote-unquote, think what you will, we seize into our hands his plate, his goods, his money, and his lands. Act 2, Scene 1, Lines 209 through 210. The king sees no reason why he should respect the rights of a man whom he has sent into long exile, and with whom he already had an unpleasant history. Richard's next move is startling. York has just accused him of spitting on his entire royal line, but now the king uses this family connection, his uncle, to prop up his authority. He leaves York, whom he apparently considers docile enough to trust, in charge of managing the kingdom while he himself goes off to deal with a rebellion in Ireland. Northumberland, Henry Percy, father of Harry Hotspur, Ross, and Willoughby remain behind and rehearse Richard's offenses, saying that he is, quote-unquote, basely led by flatterers. Act 2, Scene 1, lines 241 through 242. They say as well that he has managed to anger both the nobility and the commoners in the realm by imposing extortionate fines, taxes, and whatnot. To be fair, this is not drastically different from the way the rest of England's early kings treated their subjects. All the same, Richard has lost almost everyone's respect and the loyalty of many. Conspiracy and rebellion can't be far behind. Northumberland has cheering news about that eventuality. He has heard that Henry Bolingbroke has gathered some of England's great lords in his cause and is already on the way across the Channel. Backing him are, quote-unquote, 8 tall ships and, quote-unquote, 3,000 men of war, says Northumberland, and all this affords Richard's enemies a fine chance to, quote-unquote, make High Majesty look like itself again. Act 2, Scene 1, line 286 and line 295. Here am I left to underprop his land, who weak with age cannot support myself. Bolingbroke has landed with an army in England at Ravenspur. The Duke of York faces an ethical quandary over which nephew to support, King Richard or Bolingbroke. In Act 2, Scene 2, Green tells Richard's queen that Henry Bolingbroke is back in England in defiance of his banishment. He has landed safely at Ravenspur along the east coast. The queen is more of a realist than her husband and says disconsolately, quote-unquote, I will despair and be at enmity with cozening hope. He is a flatterer, a parasite, a keeper back of death. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 68 through 70. Still, when she sees York coming her way, she asks him fervently to, quote-unquote, speak comfortable words. Act 2, Scene 2, line 76. But Uncle Edmund of Langley, Duke of York, has no such words. He informs the queen that King Richard is out of the country and that he himself has been tasked with holding down the fort, so to speak, or what's left of it. York sounds none too sure of himself by this point, saying, quote-unquote, here am I left to underprop his land, who, weak with age, cannot support myself. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 81 through 82. It won't take much effort on Bolingbroke's part to sway him. News soon arrives that the Duchess of Gloucester, widow of the murdered Thomas of Woodstock, Duke of Gloucester, has died. With the situation crumbling around him, York weighs his loyalties with an earnestness that is ominous for the absent King Richard. With whom should he ally himself? He says, quote-unquote, the one is my sovereign, whom both my oath and duty bid defend. The other, again, is my kinsman, whom the king hath wronged. Act 2, Scene 2, lines 310 through 313. Thus far, all York can bring himself to say is, quote-unquote, well, somewhat, we must do. Act 2, Scene 2, line 16. York tells Bushy, Bagot, and Green to get their troops together and meet him at Berkeley Castle. But only Bagot chooses to make his way towards King Richard in Ireland. Bushy and Green decide to save themselves by seeking refuge at Wiltshire Castle, where they hope that William Le Scrope, 1st Earl of Wiltshire, will protect them. Thou art a banished man, and here art come before the expiration of thy time. The Duke of York upbraids Bolingbroke as a traitor in a meeting outside Berkeley Castle, but confesses that he has no power to stop him and invites him to stay at the castle. In Act II, Scene 3, Northumberland introduces his son, Harry Percy, the gallant Hotspur of the Henry IV plays, to Bolingbroke, the beginning of a fraught connection between these two ambitious young men. Harry doesn't seem to recognize his illustrious colleague, but Bolingbroke is kind to him when they meet, telling him, quote unquote, "I count myself in nothing else so happy as in a soul remembering my good friends." Act 2, Scene 3, lines 46 through 47. Henry Bolingbroke again shows us his strength as both a politician and a realist. He describes himself starkly as, quote unquote, "a banished traitor in the eyes of the opponent," and gracefully expresses his gratitude to his supporters with, quote unquote, "evermore thanks, the exchequer of the poor, which till my infant fortune comes to years, stands for my bounty." Act 2, Scene 3, lines 60 and lines 65 through 67. This is a man who, at least at this point in his career, knows how to gain and keep loyalty. He refrains from promising what he doesn't have, yet manages to paint himself as the quintessential good chieftain. Soon enough, the principal players get to the affair at hand. Bolingbroke informs Lord Berkeley that he will answer only to the title of Lancaster, and not to Hereford, now that he is the rightful inheritor of his father, John of Gaunt, the late Duke of Lancaster. York, however, isn't impressed with Bolingbroke's courtly words. The younger man's graceful comportment, York makes plain, does not conceal the fact that his return to England amounts to treason, a word that Bolingbroke, we may remember, has already applied to himself. At least ironically, York tells the upstart bluntly, quote unquote, "Thou art a banished man, and here art come before the expiration of thy time, in braving arms against thy sovereign." Act 2, Scene 3, lines 109 through 111. Bolingbroke, however, has a case to make for himself that is, in its essentials, undeniable. Quote unquote, "Wherefore was I born?" he asks York. Quote unquote, "If that my cousin king be king of England, it must be granted I am Duke of Lancaster." Act 2, Scene 3, lines 121 through 123. Claiming that he has been denied proper legal counsel, he has, he insists, simply come to England to tender his claim to his, quote-unquote, "inheritance of free descent." Act 2, Scene 3, line 135. Ross and Willoughby chime in to bolster Bolingbroke's case, with the latter tellingly pointing out something dear to English royalty. Regarding Richard, he says, quote-unquote, "base men by his endowments are made great." Act 2, Scene 3, line 138. This severe slippage in rank and status is apparently intolerable to the likes of Willoughby. Northumberland claims in Bolingbroke's defense that the young man has only come all this way, quote unquote, "but for his own." Act 2, Scene 3, line 148. That is, he has come for his patrimony as Duke of Lancaster. It's common sense that a subject, however, cannot engage in rebellion and then expect a deal forced upon the king to be honored. At this point, York's realism kicks in, and he admits to all present that his forces are too weak to serve as Richard II's enforcer. He therefore declares himself, quote unquote, "neuter," and immediately invites the man he has just called a traitor to, quote unquote, "repose for the night at Berkeley Castle." Act 2, Scene 3, line 158 and line 160. Taking full advantage of this breakthrough, Bolingbroke pushes farther. he holds it necessary, he tells York, to make a trip to Bristol Castle, where he will seize Bushy, Bagot, and all their accomplices, quote-unquote, the caterpillars of the Commonwealth, as he calls them. Act 2, Scene 3, line 165. York professes to be of both minds, even about this demand, saying only that he may or may not go. By now, York's neutrality seems almost nihilistic. As he says, quote-unquote, things past redress are now with me past care. Act 2, Scene 3, line 170. Although Thomas Hobbes will not set forth his theory of royal absolutism in Leviathan until 1651, the Duke of York's reaction to Bolingbroke's attack illustrates the paradox in Hobbes's treatise. Rebellion is illegitimate and inadmissible, but if it succeeds, the rebel becomes the new absolute power, against whom nobody may rebel, unless, of course, they do it successfully. York knows the score. Things have gone far beyond the point of no return, so there's no point in continuing to back King Richard, who no longer has any effective fighting force and has lost the loyalty of his subjects from low status to high. Bolingbroke, with his army at his side, is already the de facto ruler, and he will soon rule de jure. The bay trees in our country are all withered, and meteors fright the fixed stars of heaven. A Welsh captain informs Salisbury that, thanks to King Richard's absence and to several ill omens, many of his troops have been dismissed. In Act 2, Scene 4, a Welsh captain reports to one of the king's last remaining loyalists, John Montague, 3rd Earl of Salisbury. He is full of misgivings, is this Welsh captain. He tells Salisbury, quote-unquote, the bay trees in our country all are withered, and meteors fright the fixed stars of heaven. Act 2, Scene 4, lines 8 through 9. This and other astronomical and behavioral portents tells the captain that there is more than enough chaos for him to let his men return to their homes. Salisbury himself feels the meaning of the portents deeply and concludes as if addressing Richard, quote-unquote, thy friends are fled to wait upon thy foes, and crossly to thy good all fortune goes. Act 2, Scene 4, lines 23 through 24. It's easy for modern readers and viewers to dismiss talk of portents, but Shakespeare often seems, like many of his contemporaries, to be of two minds about what we would call superstition. The theory of man the microcosm held, after all, that humans contain within themselves the elements of all that is above and below them on the great ladder or chain of being. If that's the case, chaos in the heavens might well correspond to chaos, whether brewing or present, in the sublunary realm, or, as we say, on the ground. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Saturday, September 27th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.